Chapter 4. There were no viewports or displays for Elith to watch as they made their final approach to Ruhet 1117, but she felt the transitions as the vessel staged its radiant deceleration and again when it shifted to atmospheric flight. Though there was no obvious signal, shortly after they entered the atmosphere, she heard movement among the team behind her. As the craft slowed for its final descent, all 12 troopers rose, fully geared in the Hezra's sleek, flexible armor and armed with long rifles of several different classes. Had they been deploying to an area of open conflict, they would have looked no different. The group moved to stack up by the rear hatch. The moment the craft touched down, the hatch opened, and the team flowed out with practiced precision. Ames stood by for several minutes before giving them the all clear. When their turn came, he gave Elith a quick wink as if to say everything was under control. But the tension in his jaw and the hardness in his eyes told her of the fear he too was fighting. Previously, Ames had always allowed Nieta and Elith to pass through doors ahead of him, a mild but uncommon deference to their status within the house. This time, however, he took the lead through the hatch, leaving Elith to be the last to step out of the craft. So it was that her first real view of the planet came through her own eyes as she stepped up to the hatch and looked out at the landing site. Her immediate impression was that it couldn't possibly be real. The landscape was familiar enough, a wide clearing ringed with trees, hills rolling away. A bit idyllic, perhaps, but not out of sync with the general features of any other Ascendant's world. The colors, however, were so vivid and striking that they seemed hyper-real, as though they'd been tuned through some filtering process to maximize their impact. Elith felt that she was now, for the first time, seeing what green truly was, that here on this world, green had its source, and everywhere else she'd ever seen it had merely been a thin shadow or husk of the real thing. And the same was true of all the colors across the landscape, the reds and yellows of the wildflowers that dotted the clearing, the clear blue of the sky, even the tans and browns of the earth. Every shade and hue created the same impression of a reality fuller and somehow more substantial than any she'd witnessed before. Elith inhaled deeply and noted the crisp freshness of the air. It was intensely so, fragrant with the health of its earth and trees, but so clear and clean that it seemed to have been created only moments before she'd breathed in. Fresh hardly captured the quality. Newborn was more accurate. She walked down the ship's boarding ramp in a mild trance. A light breeze rose briefly and swirled, a gentle greeting gust that stirred the sun-warmed air around her in playful welcome. The troopers had formed a security perimeter around the landing site, and though they were all stationed at their designated posts, they too seemed to be feeling the same effects of this springtime world. As Elith's foot touched the planet's surface, it struck her suddenly that she was breathing air that until recently had been completely devoid of human breath. She wasn't quite sure how much time passed before she came fully back to herself, a few seconds or a few minutes. It was the sound of Captain Ames's voice that recalled her to the moment and to their task.
"Team bangers on the ground and secure," he said, speaking into his communicator.
His tone was professional but subdued, as though he were hesitant to disturb some sacred silence.
"You're clear to bring it down."
A few moments later, a distant grumble became apparent, and then grew into a growling roar as Vanquin, the supporting gunship, approached. As they descended, Elith noted how flat and dull they seemed now compared to the vibrant life of Quell's shadow. The intrusion seemed vulgar in that setting, but the ship's arrival appeared to break whatever gentle spell had fallen over the security team. Their activity became sharper and quick conversations more frequent as the gunship touched down nearby.
The Clariana, the third, largest vessel, remained somewhere above them in close orbit, and Elith guessed Sardis was up there now, watching everything unfold, making his condescending comments from the safety of his command and control station. She was quite surprised then when the gunship touched down and the envoy was the first to step off, with Karush and Subo close behind. Apparently, she'd misjudged at least one quality of the man. And though she hadn't imagined it possible when she'd first met the Azirim, Karush looked even more formidable, outfitted now in the sleekest suit of armor Elith had ever seen. It was reminiscent of the armor Nyeda had worn when she'd captured Elith, though his was more elegant, and he wore no helmet. As before, his void edge hung gripped down on his chest, and from the way he and Subo moved, it was clear they served as close escort for Sardis. Watching their approach, Elith wondered what connection Karush shared with the machine, whether they were in some sort of constant communication, enabling the Azirim to command it, or if, rather, Subo were fully autonomous and tuned to read and follow Karush's intent. Or there was some other mechanism beyond her ability to discern. Whatever the case, she got the impression that the pair operated in tight coordination and might as well have been two limbs of the same mind. Captain Ames met them halfway, and they held a brief, quiet conference. Despite the ease of their landing and the serene environment that had greeted them, Elith could tell from the intensity of their expressions that something had already gone wrong. After a couple of minutes, Sardis returned to the gunship with Karush and Subo in tow. Ames walked over to one of the troopers and spoke for some time before joining Nyeda and Elith. "Bad start?" Elith asked as he approached. Ames shook his head, but his look was troubled. "No, start was just fine," he said. "Just trying to decide whether or not we set up base camp here or if we should load back up and check around for another spot."
"Isn't that the kind of thing you usually decide before you set down?" Nyeda asked.
"Sure is," he answered, "but usually our data's better."
He scanned the landscape around them, and the sharpness of his focus gave Elith the impression that it was no casual survey. It seemed more like he was either memorizing the geographical details or comparing what he saw against some previously prepared mental map.
"The location doesn't match what you expected," she said.
"No, it does not," Ames said, continuing his slow inspection of the surroundings for a few moments longer.
"This is where the first team made landing, or at least, that's what we thought. But as you can see," he said, sweeping an arm out toward the tree line, "no ship, no camp, no sign that anyone's ever been here or anywhere nearby."
Elith and Nyeda both turned to face the open expanse between their ship and the first line of trees.
"Topography's different, too, from the scans they sent back before they entered the atmosphere," Ames added. "So, either we got the coordinates wrong, or they did."
"You think they fell off course?" Nyeda asked.
Ames shrugged.
"Possible. Unlikely, I think, but possible. Could just be they didn't want us to know where they actually were."
"I'm certain you're not suggesting they would have purposely sent back false data," Nyeda said.
She kept her tone even, but Elith knew the woman well enough to hear the anger at the accusation.
"Me? Not really," Ames said. "That's the envoy's take on it, though. I think he's already under the impression that First House knew more than they wanted to share. And if we're all being honest, I think we can at least agree it wouldn't be that unusual, given the House's usual mode of operation."
Nyeda didn't like the implication, but she didn't argue it either.
"Seems like we could narrow the possibilities down easily enough," Elith said. "A landing site can't be too hard to find, or a crash site, for that matter."
"Yeah, but that's,
Ames said, trailing off, not quite sure how to finish whatever it was he'd been about to say.
"That isn't a priority," a voice said from behind them.
They all turned to find Sardis walking the last few steps to join them.
"We'll set up here," Sardis continued, It seems foolish to abandon our plan quite so quickly, particularly when I'm certain we'll have much greater cause to do so later. Captain Ames, what measures remain before we can begin?
Scans all looked clear coming in, Ames answered, but I'd still like to get over and walk the perimeter for myself before we commit.
An hour? Sardis asked.
Two would be better.
An hour, then, Sardis said. I want Arbiter Oyun's detachment on site and working within three.
Understood, Ames said. He gave Elith and Yetta a quick bow and headed off to talk with one of his troopers. Elith watched the interaction and noted how it seemed to play out more like a negotiation between peers rather than a superior officer giving orders. The trooper listened to whatever it was that Ames had to say, then offered some counterpoint or suggestion of his own, to which Ames acquiesced. They parted, Ames headed to the transport, and the trooper toward the security line the rest of his team was still holding.
Elith recalled what Ames had said about being a guest, just like them, and now the arrangement started to become clearer in her mind. Whatever Captain Ames's background was, she gathered that he was serving as an advisor or in some specialist capacity. The troopers were in support of him, but not under his command. She didn't know how that would play out as the operation unfolded, but later, when the initial rush of activity had settled, she planned to see what more she could learn of Ames. As Captain Ames entered the transport, a second group coming from the gunship caught Elith's attention. Karush and his ever-present machine companion Subo were at the head, leading a pair of troopers toward the envoy.
I should accompany Captain Ames, Nieta said.
Out of the question, Sardis answered, so quickly it was as if in reflex. I'm not here to stand around and watch, envoy.
Oh, you most certainly are here to watch, advocate, until I decide otherwise.
Karush and his contingent arrived, but waited silently at a respectful distance.
Do not forget who I serve, Nieta said with some heat. I'm not beholden to your Hezra Ka, and...
It's simply logistics, Sardis said, cutting her off. A practical matter. This may be difficult to imagine, but the two of you are the least of my concerns at the moment. I don't need the distraction of keeping track of your whereabouts, particularly if events necessitate a hasty relocation.
Sardis glanced away, his gaze drawn by motion.
Elith looked, too, and saw that Ames had returned from the transport. He was now armed and kitted up. But instead of returning to them, he was moving out to meet a group of four Hezra troopers who'd come off the security line. When he reached them, they headed out together toward the tree line, some 500 yards or so distant.
Make the most of your downtime, Sardis said, turning back to Nieta and Elith. You're not likely to have much more of it once we get started.
He turned to address the troopers, standing off to one side, who had been serving as Karush's escort.
You two, come with me. I'm going to take a look around for myself. Karush, you stay here.
I cannot advise it, envoy, Karush said.
Recall that you have two purposes to attend to, Azirim, Sardis said. Neither of which is to... advise. You should remain on hand in case your work is required. Don't worry. I'm not the helpless sort of thing you're used to playing nanny for.
As you say, envoy,
Karush answered with utmost respect, despite clearly disagreeing with Sardis's self-assessment. Sardis flicked a hand at the two troopers, signaling for them to join him, but started marching off without waiting for them to do so. He took a path roughly perpendicular to Captain Ames's direction of travel, his strides long and purposeful, as though he knew exactly where he was going and what he was looking for. Watching him go, it was hard for Elith to judge whether that was true or if it was an act intended to maintain his status among the hard-edged troopers under his command. Karush, too, watched the envoy for a span. His posture was relaxed, but Elith got the impression that if anything moved to harm Sardis, the Azirim would respond as quickly as if he'd been anticipating it. Eventually, he turned briefly back, looking first at Nieta and then at Elith.
The intensity of his look had an almost physical weight to it, but he said nothing to them before he turned his attention outward once more. He'd made it clear that he had no intention of addressing them. That didn't prevent Nieta from speaking her mind.
"Envoy or not, that man shouldn't get used to issuing commands," she said.
After a moment, she added, "or at least to expecting them to be followed without question."
Elith glanced at Karush to gauge his reaction. There was none. He seemed to take no more notice of them than the silent, hulking machine of his that stood nearby. But she could tell that he was alert and attuned to their every movement, even as he scanned the horizon. For the next 10 minutes, the odd group stood in strained silence until Karush reacted to movement off to his right. The others followed his gaze and saw Captain Ames already returning with his team. Both Ames's pace and his expression suggested he'd found something he really didn't like. As he drew closer, they could hear him speaking into his communicator, and though he was maintaining his professionalism, it was obvious he was arguing against whatever he was hearing from the other side.
"No, sir. I'm not. I understand, envoy. I'm not suggesting we wait for guarantees," he said.
He reached the troopers holding the close security perimeter and signaled for everyone to group up while he continued his response.
"Sir, you asked for my expert opinion, and my expert opinion is that we should give it a full day cycle before we ask anyone else to come down here."
He stopped a few yards away from Elith and her companions, excluding them from the others, but apparently not concerned about them overhearing what he had to say. Ames was silent for a few moments, listening to the reply, and he held up a finger to hold off any questions until the conversation was done.
"Yes, sir," he said. "Yes, sir, I understand. Will do."
He shook his head before addressing the troopers gathered around him. They all kept their voices lowered just enough to keep Elith from being able to discern exactly what they were saying. But given what she'd already heard and what she could read from their body language, she picked up enough. They were moving ahead with establishing a base camp, even though whatever Ames had found had spooked him enough to advise against it. Resigned, Captain Ames continued over to Elith's group to give them a quick debrief. His demeanor was sharp, intense with focus and clarity. His easy, casual nature had completely evaporated. She recognized that look, knew what he was feeling. She'd felt it herself many times before. It was the weight of duty, forcing an advance into danger over the caution advised.
"We're going to go ahead and bring the research vanguard down," he said. "It's going to be a couple of hours of scramble and dust while everything gets set up. Until then, Karush, any chance you can persuade the envoy to get back to the gunship?"
Karush dipped his head in acknowledgement and then turned and strode off to retrieve Sardis. As he passed Subo, without any obvious signal or command, the machine flowed into an escort position just off the Azarim's shoulder and slightly behind.
"And daughters of the house," Ames said, "if you will, I need you to load back up on the transport until we get squared away out here."
Ames held out a hand to direct the two women back aboard the transport.
"Everything okay, Captain?" Elith asked.
"Doubt it," he answered. "I don't mind if you two hang out by the ramp, if you want to keep an eye out, but do not wander off, not even 50 feet. Is that clear?"
"What did you find out there?"
Ames glanced back at the tree line, hesitated for a few seconds.
"It's not what's out there so much," he said. "It's the ground here that I don't like."
He started to lead them toward the ship, but stopped after a couple of steps and shook his head. He turned, leaned closer, lowered his voice as though confiding more to them than he ought.
"Clariana ran narrow atmospheric analysis and picked up particle traces from the first team's ship, local to here. So while we were out there, we shot bearing back to them from 5 separate locations, and every single one of them confirmed the coordinates."
He paused, troubled by the implications. Elith interpreted his message. The Paragon's ship had indeed entered the atmosphere along the vector they'd communicated back to the Hezra, but there was no sign anywhere that they'd touched down.
You mean they set down somewhere nearby? Nyetta asked.
No, Ames said.
I mean, as far as we can tell, they set down right here. We're in the right place. It's almost like...
He shook his head again, scowled at the horizon, wrestling with whether he should tell them or not, or perhaps just trying to find the words to describe it.
Like what? Elith prompted.
He looked her in the eye.
Like, it's the land that's changed.
Chapter 5. Elith and Nyetta remained aboard the Atarin, seated on the deck at the top of the boarding ramp, and watched as the Hezra personnel scurried around the landing site to finish establishing the first footprint of their base camp. Shortly after Ames had directed them back to the vessel, a small fleet of automated craft from the Clariana had made landing. On their approach, Elith had initially taken them to be shuttles for the rest of the team, but as they touched down, she realized they were all too small and too flat to carry any crew. They'd landed in formation, a central cluster with an outer ring. Even before the troopers had begun their work, Elith had discerned the ship's actual purpose. Some were supply craft, but most were self-deploying structures. It was a ready-made camp, dropped from orbit. Watching them work, Elith estimated that within an hour the small team would have transformed the grassy clearing into a Spartan but functional base of operations. For all the technological prowess of the Hezra, still nothing impressed Elith as much as the hierarchy's logistical efficiency. A third landing craft had joined them not long after the first of the structures had been fully deployed, this one a small shuttle pod from the Clariana. Arbiter Oyun had stepped out, followed by two assistants that Elith hadn't yet met, but they'd quickly disappeared into the centermost structure along with Sardis. They hadn't reemerged, and still no one had given Elith or Nyetta any further instructions. The two women sat together in an active silence, until at last Elith let slip the first of the many questions that haunted her mind.
"Did you know, Nyetta," she asked, "that the Paragon herself was leaving the Vaunt to come here?"
Nyetta didn't respond at first. For a few long seconds, she just continued to watch the activity on the ground. But Elith knew her former sister deeply and saw in her hesitation the tumble of questioning, of memory reawakened and often rehearsed. She guessed an answer before Nyetta spoke it.
"You did know," Elith said.
"Because she asked you to help prepare the plan?"
Nyetta glanced at her.
"No," she answered, and then looked away again.
"No, the plan was in place before she spoke with me. And when I volunteered to join her, she wouldn't allow it. She charged me with a different task."
The pain of the admission shone through. Elith understood then the churn of emotion she saw in Nyetta, the regret of having been left behind, the guilt of survival when others were lost, and the weight of that guilt hinted at the magnitude of the loss.
"How many went with her?" Elith asked.
16, she answered. 8 of the hand, 4 of the eye, 2 of the mind, and 2 of the voice. The loss of so many advocates was a tragedy almost unimaginable for the house. But to lose 2 from the voice cut even more deeply. Their numbers were already so few. Elith sat quietly, her eyes fixed intently on Nyetta, waiting for her to speak the names of her sisters.
"Umarai," she said.
"And Dmini."
Her head tipped forward, bracing against a gale of sorrow.
The fingers of an arctic grief clasped Elith's heart.
Umarai and Mini. At the mention of their names, long-neglected memories erupted, peppering her with fragments of emotion. Umarai was a few years younger than Elith, and though the two had never been especially close, Elith had always liked her and knew how highly regarded she was within the Order. That she had been trusted to accompany the Paragon was no surprise. And Dimini. After Nyeta, Dimini had been the dearest of Elith's siblings. They had been aspirants together, had trained together, studied together. And though Elith had been brought into the Voice much earlier, when it came time to decide Dimini's place in the house, Elith had served as her sponsor and championed her before the elders of the Order. To lose them both was a devastating blow. Elith had lost sisters before, but she realized in that moment how naive she'd been during her exile. Despite knowing intellectually that it couldn't be true, she saw now that after she'd left the house, she'd allowed herself to behave as though her former order would continue on just as she'd left it, that her sisters in arms would live forever exactly as they'd been when she'd departed. Though she'd said goodbye to them in her heart when their ways had parted, she'd never properly embraced the idea that their lives, too, would follow their own courses and might find their own end. In the midst of her unexpected grief, Elith saw Nieta's great burden, knew how she must have wrestled with the thousand different, if only I had, thoughts that plagued her mind. Indeed, as gifted and devoted as Umarai and Dimini had both been, neither of them stood above Nieta in the Order. That the Paragon had denied her the chance to serve in their place must have led her to a crisis of self-doubt of near-crippling magnitude. And though Elith no longer served alongside her, she still loved Nieta dearly. "Nieta," she said. The illumined mother alone made her choices, and nothing you could have done would have swayed her from her own purposes. "I know," Nieta said quietly. After a moment, she raised her head again, and with eyes clearer, gazed out at the surface of the planet once more. "I didn't understand it at the time, but I believe I'm beginning to." "Surely she knew the Order would need your strength and leadership in her absence." "No," Nieta said. "I think she knew I'd have to be the one to find you." For all the certainty in Nieta's voice, the words didn't clear any confusion in Elith's mind. That the Paragon herself would have anticipated her involvement, to say nothing of having planned for it, only added further mystery to already complicated circumstances. "I don't see how that could be true," she said. "I don't understand why she would think I would have any part to play in this."
"Neither do I," she replied. "Only you know what passed between the two of you before you chose to leave."
"Before you chose to leave." Those last words held the greatest weight. Until now, Elith had assumed that her exile from the First House had been presented as an edict from the Paragon. In truth, Elith had rejected the path offered by the Paragon that would have allowed for her to continue to serve the House. Not only rejected it, but prevailed against the Paragon's efforts to command it of her. Elith had believed those events remained known only to the two of them. But Nieta's claim that Elith had chosen to leave made it plain that she, at least, knew something of the truth. "Is it known to the House that I chose this path for myself?" "Not by many. The Illumined Mother revealed it to me just before she left. Whether she's told others, I can't say." Nieta paused briefly, but then added, "It was a strange time, to be taken into her confidence that way, to be singled out, charged with so heavy a duty, to keep so deep a secret when all our lives have been so strongly commanded toward openness and connection." Elith knew well the feelings of both inclusion and isolation that Nieta described.
the honor and burden of the Paragon's trust. She'd experienced it herself when she'd been dispatched to Quell. And she knew, too, how the Paragon had used those tools to manipulate the situation to her own hidden ends. "I have no doubt you've told me the truth as you've seen it," Eleth said, "but I still can't see the Paragon's true purpose in all of this. No matter what threat she foresaw, I can't comprehend why she would choose to lead a team herself. It has never been her way to put herself at risk when she has so many others at her command." Nieta bristled at her words. "The Illumined Mother has never hesitated to give any measure of herself for the sake of her house and for her daughters," she said. "She felt responsible, felt it was her duty, or her penance, perhaps, for having failed to adequately control you." "So she did believe I was the cause of this. She thought it possible, and you must consider it too. Whatever happened on Quell, whatever it was that you did, it shook the Ascendance at its roots. Our house had to be the one to step forward to account for whatever this is." She waved her hand at the land outside the ship. Eleth looked at the surface of the world before them, pondering what secrets the Paragon had perceived in its earth. No matter what Nieta told her, Eleth could not bring herself to believe that the Paragon's motives for being first on the planet were so purely noble and willingly self-sacrificial. "Then why would she not seek me out first, Nieta? Why risk herself if she believed I was the one responsible?"
"Because she feared you, exile," Nieta said, heat rising. "Do you still not understand? The Paragon of the First House of the Ascendance feared you in a way I have never witnessed in her before."
She paused again, settled herself.
"But I think, too, that she knew something deeper, either about the deep language itself or more likely about you, something she saw in you that no one else can perceive, not even yourself. Certainly not me. And yet you sought me out. Something gave her courage enough to at least consider the possibility that you might not prove an enemy after all. It's her job to consider all possibilities and to choose her course from among many paths. That's the responsibility of the Paragon." "Spoken like someone who has never known the weight of that burden," Nieta answered. And though her tone was even, Eleth heard the anger seething beneath the words. Nieta could get loud when she wanted to, but she was most frightening when she went quiet. "You've never had to confront the kind of uncertainty that the Illumined Mother navigates on our behalf. Never had to discern what action to take, knowing the consequences will reach far beyond anyone's ability to see. You were a tool in her hand, an instrument forged for her purpose. And I will never understand how you could turn against her, how you could turn your back on our way and on our house, on me."
"Nieta," Eleth said.
"Don't, exile,"
she answered, with the quiet sharpness of a keen blade. She remained perfectly still, but the effect was the same as if she had stood up and angrily walked away. Eleth had pushed her too far, had awakened too many wounds. In her effort to draw the strands of truth together, she had forgotten how her relational distance from the Paragon was not shared by Nieta, who still suffered under the loss and uncertainty. Anything else she might say now would only serve to deepen their pain. Eleth rose to her feet, lightly touched Nieta's shoulder in silent consolation and apology, and descended the ramp. She stopped a few steps away from the craft, drew a deep breath of the pristine air, held it in her lungs. Somewhere on this world, the Paragon and 16 women of the house had vanished. And for all the appearances that something had gone catastrophically wrong, Eleth just could not find herself fully convinced that she wasn't somehow still trapped in a cosmic web
weaved by her former sovereign. She scanned around her at the transformed landing zone, where the Hezra personnel seemed to be in the final stages of setting up their camp. The two main ships flanked the southern end of the site, with a compact but stout structure in between that had an aggressive, bunker-like appearance. In fact, now that the structures were all arranged and deployed, the location looked more like a tiny combat outpost than any sort of research station. Typically, it would have struck Elith as being classic Hezra over-aggression. Given what they knew of the planet so far, though, she had to admit that in this case it might not have been the wrong approach. Four troopers maintained security, each posted in pop-up towers at the edges of the site that were little more than platforms raised 6 feet off the ground. Under their guard, the rest worked on the finishing touches, some unloading supplies from the back of a utility skimmer, others distributing gear with the aid of sleek-powered exoskeleton striders, still others testing power distributors to ensure they had good coverage across the camp. But Elith noted how all of them kept their weapons close at hand, and how alert they remained to their surroundings. A few moments later, she understood why they were so on edge. Off to the west, a strange noise arose, some distance away, a knocking sound from deep within the surrounding woods, like two large trees driven together in the wind, slow but rhythmic. It lasted only 10 seconds or so, but while it lasted, every single person in the camp was completely still. And after it stopped, it took a few moments more before anyone resumed their activity. Elith hadn't heard the sound while she'd been in the Atarin, but based on the reaction of the others, she could tell it wasn't the first time that they had. She wondered if it was closer now than it had been before. She glanced back up the ramp to gauge whether or not Nieta had heard it as well. But her former sister was no longer sitting there, having apparently retreated somewhere deeper into the craft. When she looked back, motion from the center of the camp drew her eye, and she saw Captain Ames coming out of the center structure, followed by Sardis and Arbiter Oyun. The trio paused a few steps outside and formed a half circle facing the direction of the sound, clearly in discussion about it. Elith had had enough of sitting around. She decided to insert herself into the conversation. Ames was the first to notice her approach, and he acknowledged her with a quick nod and a subtle gesture for her to join them. Sardis glanced in her direction, but didn't seem to take any particular note of her as he continued on with whatever he was in the middle of saying. Elith took the lack of a clear demand to halt as tacit approval of her presence. She stopped next to Oyun, who gave her a brief smile in greeting. "Anything I can't handle on my own, I'm certain Kurush can manage," Sardis said to Ames. "If that's your concern?" "It's one of my concerns, yes," Ames replied. "But there's still so much we just don't know, sir, and not all threats can be shot to death." "Clearly you haven't seen Subo in action," Sardis said. "But very well. I will acquiesce if you agree to keep the contingent small enough. I want this site operational, and I'm not willing to lose time just so your friends can go stomping around in the woods." "Sure, I can keep it real small," Ames said, "as long as you agree not to argue with me about who I bring along." The knocking came again from the woods, from roughly the same distance and direction as before. Conversation ceased for the duration. Though it didn't continue as long this time, Elith was struck by the consistency of both the sound and its rhythm. Each individual knock had a benign, natural quality to it that wouldn't have seemed out of place to anyone who'd spent as much time in the wilderness as she had. Close-grown trees swaying out of sync, or thick branches meeting in the wind. But it was much too loud. And taken together in sequence, the steady rhythm and identical amplitude of the knocks seemed tinged with intent. It was the suggestion of purpose that produced such an unsettling effect. "Fine," Sardis said, as the sound faded. Go pick your best. And be quick about it.
Great, the captain said, and then his eyes went to Elith.
How do you feel about a little scouting trip?
Sardis shifted his gaze back and forth between the two of them.
No, he said. You literally just agreed not to argue with me, Ames said, because I assumed you were speaking of bringing one or two from your assigned unit. First off, she is part of my assigned unit, Ames countered. Second, we can take one of her, or eight of the others. You want to keep things small? She's the smart choice.
The envoy clearly didn't like the argument, but the fact that he didn't have an immediate reply suggested he might actually be considering it. Ames pressed his momentary advantage.
All due respect, sir. You're the one all hot to get things moving here. If we're going to be out there poking around anyway, might as well get her started, too. Leaves the rest of the crew here working. Just like you want.
Sardis turned his full attention on Elith, then.
It seems the captain here would like to provide you with your first opportunity to fail us, he said. I don't suppose you are wise enough to decline?
His towering stature, combined with the intensity of his stare, would have been oppressive to any normal person. But Elith was a woman who had beheld the infinite cosmos and the power that held it all together. To her eyes, in that moment, he seemed small and insubstantial.
I'm here to serve, Elith answered with a precisely respectful bow, and I wouldn't dare refuse the direction of the officer whom you and your wisdom placed in authority over me.
Sardis grunted, and though it happened so quickly she thought she might have imagined it, the shape of his mouth twitched in what might have been a millisecond show of surprise, or perhaps even something bordering on amusement.
Your graciousness astounds, he said,
all trace of positive emotion replaced with his usual acidic tone. He pointed to the westmost bunker.
15 minutes. Meet there. I will depart on time, regardless of who is with me.
He turned to address Oyun.
Arbiter, dare I believe that you possess the capacity to maintain order for as much as an entire hour?
Chaos is fundamental to the universe, Envoy, Oyun said. And I don't like to make promises, but I don't think I'll manage to burn the entire place down in that short window.
Sardis fixed him with his hard stare.
It would take me at least two,
Oyun finished. Sardis lingered a moment longer, apparently searching for a sufficiently biting reply and unable to come up with one.
15 minutes,
he finally said. He swiveled abruptly and set off with his long strides toward the Vanquin.
I'm not entirely sure he likes us, Ames said.
He is not a nice man at heart,
Oyun replied, briefly watching the envoy walk away. He then looked back to Ames and Elith, each in turn.
But nice and good aren't the same thing, and he is effective. It's not without reason that the Hezraqa charged him with this task. It would be a mistake to underestimate him.
His expression was deeply serious, and his warning clear. After a moment, though, in characteristic fashion, he smiled and added,
though it could be a mistake to believe everything he says about himself.
He reached out a hand to each of them, clasped their arms just above the elbow, and squeezed. Even in gentle encouragement, the strength in his grip told Elith he hadn't spent his entire life in a lab.
Be careful. Watch yourselves, he said, and take good notes. I can't wait to hear what you find.
I'll be sure to bring you a little something back, Arbiter, Ames said, clapping Oyun on the shoulder.
Oyun nodded and headed back to the central structure.
Nothing wriggly, he called over his shoulder, or with too many legs.
Roger that, Ames said.
Once Oyun had gone, he turned his attention to Elith.
You sure you're good with this?
Of course, she answered. I'm dying to do something useful, and I assumed you had a good reason for suggesting it.
Not sure it's a good reason, but a reason, yeah, he said.
He motioned for her to follow him and started leading her back toward the Atarin as he continued, "Now, as you've probably noticed, I'm not the most educated man, so admittedly I'm pretty ignorant of how you folks do what you do, but I do at least understand that you can see things in a way that's different from how any of us can. I got a little sense of the area my first time out, but I'd really appreciate getting your perspective on this place." Elith found herself glad to hear that Ames apparently wanted her along just to get her read on the nature of the planet. Whatever else the envoy might have had in mind for her, helping investigate the ecology of the strange world seemed like something useful and beneficial she could do in the meantime. "Just point me where you want me to go, Captain. For the moment, I want you right beside me," he said. And then he flashed a smile. "Maybe a few steps ahead, actually. But first, let me run you back to the Atarin and get you kitted up. I have no doubt Sardis will leave without us if we give him any reason." He picked up his pace and led her back to the transport at a half jog and spoke into a communicator along the way. "Hey, Tal, you on board Atarin?" he said. "Great. Can you pull a standard rig for me real quick? I'm taking one of our VIPs out for a walk." "Nope. The other one." "Yeah, just the kit." "Thanks." They slowed to a brisk walk as they approached the ramp, and by the time they reached the top, one of the Hezra troopers was already walking down the main aisle, carrying a small pack by its straps and a bulky bundle under one arm. Elith recognized her as one of the troopers that had accompanied Sardis on his first trip out. "Tal," she assumed. "Hey, Pops," Tal said. Elith spotted the insignia on her uniform, identifying her as a sergeant first class, which made her one of the higher-ranking enlisted troopers of the task force. They met in the middle, and Ames continued past her, while pointing back at Elith. "Get her set up for me, will you? We're racing the envoy." "Hey, no pressure," she replied. Ames disappeared through a hatch, and Tal set the gear down on two of the empty seats nearby. She unrolled the bundle first, revealing it to be a soft-bodied vest striped with attachment points for other gear. A pair of gloves made of matching material flopped onto the seat. "You ever wear one of these?"
No, I haven't, Sergeant," Elith answered.
Tal held up the vest and turned it quickly to show both front and back. It was matte black, but looking closely, Elith saw the material was comprised of small hexagons, tightly joined through some invisible mechanism. The sergeant tossed it to her. "Right arm through first," she said, gesturing as she spoke. "Wrap and seal from the left." The vest was open along the left side. Elith slipped her right arm through as directed, and then Tal helped her pull a flap around beneath her left arm. When the edge of the flap met the body of the vest, the tiny plates shifted together so completely that it appeared to be crafted from a single, unbroken piece of material. The weight was noticeable, but not uncomfortably so, and Elith could see how one could wear the vest for long periods if only it hadn't been quite so large on her. She wasn't sure if it was the wrong size or if it had been designed to be worn over heavier attire. Just before she asked, though, Tal ran a quick finger along the top of her left shoulder, and the vest responded to the gesture by gently constricting and fitting her form more snugly. Elith tested the comfort, inhaled deeply, twisted at the waist back and forth. It didn't seem to restrict her movement in the slightest.
"Don't let the weight fool you," the sergeant said. "It's nice and breathable, but apart from heat and sweat, there's not much that can get through it."
She thumped the front of the vest with a heavy fist and then picked the gloves up from where they'd fallen.
"Same stuff," she said, offering them to Elith. "Main difference is sensory pass-through. Keeps your sensitivity up to a point, dampens anything that gets too far up into your pain threshold. Takes a little getting used to, especially when you're touching something real hot or cold. The most important thing, though, is to remember when you're not wearing them. Seen a few corporals in the field pick stuff up with their bare hands that they shouldn't have. Usually only takes once to learn, but it's hilarious every time."
Elith slipped the gloves on, and just as the vest had, they subtly reconfigured to fit. With each hand, she tapped her fingertips against her thumbs in succession, pointer to pinky, and back again, testing the impact on her sense of touch. To her surprise, if she hadn't been looking at her hands, she wasn't sure she would have been able to tell she was wearing gloves at all. She looked up from the gloves to find Tal holding her small operations pack.
"Pretty sure this one's yours?"
"It is, thank you," Elith said.
"I didn't check it, since I didn't know what you put in it anyway, but whatever procurement got for you should all be there."
Elith accepted the pack and slipped it onto her shoulders. As she adjusted the straps, it occurred to her that she hadn't seen Nieta leave the craft, but neither was she in the main cabin.
"Have you seen," Elith said, and hitched just a moment, nearly having forgotten to use the address proper for her supposed station,
"Advocate Nieta?"
"Sorry, no, really haven't been keeping tabs on you two. You need her?"
"No, thank you," Elith said. "Though if she's looking for me, could you inform her that I was asked to assist Captain Ames?"
"Oh,"
Tal said, and she looked momentarily concerned.
"You sure she'll be okay with that?"
Since Elith had been presented as an attendant aspirant, the Hezra personnel considered Nieta the authority between them.
"I am," Elith answered. "My role is to provide whatever assistance is requested of me."
"All right," Tal said, though she didn't seem entirely convinced. "I'll have to remember that when my feet get sore."
She produced a small device from a pocket and attached it to the front of Elith's vest near her collarbone.
"Comms run through the vest," she explained. "This little guy here will match channels with the captain for you."
She held out a second component, this one a thin arc about an inch long, flattened at either end.
"And this piece goes over an ear. Either one, whichever's comfortable. Press the ends against your head."
Elith took the component and placed it over her ear, then pressed on the flat ends as directed. It wasn't exactly clear how, but the device felt firmly attached and didn't shift around when she turned her head back and forth.
"It's bone conducting, so it won't interfere with your normal hearing," Tal said, "and it's range dependent. Boosts signal only when it's needed. If you're next to each other, you won't hear anything different. Farther away, this little guy kicks in. Only weird part is when your guy's too far away to hear with your own ears. This thing kind of makes voices sound like they're coming from inside your head. You get used to it eventually."
Tal stepped back and gave Elith a quick once-over. As she did so, Ames reappeared, similarly geared up, though he had his short rifle slung across his chest.
"You set?" he said to Elith.
"I don't know. Do I get one of those?"
she said, nodding to the weapon.
"Only if the rest of us are dead," he answered.
"But if it comes to that, you can absolutely have mine."
He slapped Tal on the back as he passed.
"Thank you, Sergeant."
"Sure, Pops. You guys need any company out there?"
"You looking to hang out with Sardis some more?" Ames replied.
"Oh, no, sir," she answered. "Too much to do here. Busy, busy."
"Yeah, I figured," Ames said.
"Do me a favor, and don't take off without us."
"Wouldn't think of it."
"I bet you already have."
"Well, yeah, but only because of the envoy."
"You be good out there, Captain," Tal said. "Keep your comms up."
"Yep.
See you in a bit."
Tal nodded and headed back to whatever job she'd been doing before they'd interrupted her. Ames turned and started toward the ramp, and Elith followed along.
"Good kid," he said. "Tough as they come."
"Seems friendly enough," Elith said.
"Or does everyone call you Pops?"
"Just her," he said,
"on account of my great wisdom and experience.
I admit I wasn't expecting to be treated like I actually belonged here."
"Don't expect it to be universal,"
Ames replied as they walked down the ramp.
"Tal's got more sense than most, though, and she gets a pretty quick read on people. She doesn't have much patience for useless folks, no matter how high their rank or station might be. But she'll respect anybody that can do work, no matter where they come from. My guess is she can tell you're the real deal."
He started to say more, but something caught his attention and changed his focus.
He said 15 minutes,
he said to himself, and then to Elith, come on, we're going to have to double time it.
He picked up the pace to a full jog. Elith fell in just behind him, and looking ahead, saw that Sardis had already crossed halfway to the western tree line, with Karush and Subo flanking him. The trio was walking, but at a determined pace. Ames and Elith caught up with them just as they were reaching the scrub brush border of the woods.
I thought you said 15 minutes, Ames called.
Sardis paused and turned.
It didn't take us as long to prepare as I anticipated, he said. But now that you're here, would you care to take the lead?
Yes, sir, I would.
And I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't follow right up on my heels. Keeps the bears from getting us both at the same time. If they're going to get a meal that big, they ought to have to work for it.
By all means, Sardis said, dipping his head. Please show us how it's all done, Captain Ames. Ames flipped some internal switch, and his easygoing demeanor transformed immediately to all business.
I'm on point, he said. Elith, next. Leave me about 10 yards. Envoy, behind her at the same interval. And Karush, you're with the envoy. If I tell you to stop, stop immediately. And if I tell you to run, don't ask why.
As if in response to his words, the knocking sound came once more, louder this time. The group remained at the border until it stopped again.
Yeah, all right, Ames said. We're coming.
He stepped forward confidently, but with care, tuned to the environment like a man following the tracks of a wounded animal. Elith held her place until he'd gone 10 yards in, and then followed behind. And together, the small group left the relative safety of the camp, the vanguard striking out to confront the lurking unknown.